They're committed to assisting the citizens of Nome and will be spending Christmas in Dutch Harbor before coming up north.
The icebreaker Healy will help deliver fuel to Nome. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 22nd of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Jeff King makes a comeback with his sights set on another Iditarod win.
I'm going to ride my Brett Favre wave as long as I can. If I got a nice team, and I look forward to racing for years to come.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
The Coast Guard is confirming that the cutter Healy will be used to break ice for a Russian tanker in the first ever winter fuel delivery in Nome. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
The Coast Guard says that its only functioning icebreaker has gotten the go-ahead to extend its working season and escort in the fuel tanker. Coast Guard spokesperson Sarah Francis says the commander of District 17, Thomas P. Ostebo, was on board the cutter this week to speak with the crew.
They're committed to assisting the citizens of Nome and will be spending Christmas in Dutch Harbor before coming up north.
The plans are changing every day, but the Guard says the Healy will participate if four criteria are met. Those are that the Renda passes a Coast Guard inspection and that there are no excessive delays. Plus, the fuel transfer plans must meet regulatory requirements. And finally, the weather conditions must permit a safe operation. The company purchasing the fuel, the Sitnasauk Native Corporation, says having the commitment of the Healy with Coast Guard support makes the mission stronger. Board Chair Jason Evans.
Well, I think anytime you have the assistance of the United States Coast Guard and all the abilities that they have, certainly strengthens our ability to complete this mission, and then Sitnasauk, and I think the people of Nome will be forever grateful for what the Coast Guard is doing for us.
The delivery is being pushed back a few days. The Guard hopes to meet up with the tanker Renda around the new year and then head north through 300 miles of ice to Nome, arriving around the 4th or 5th of January. In anticipation of the mission, a Coast Guard C-130 flew above the ice today and around Nome to gather data on ice conditions. Francis says this is to be ready for the journey through the ice and final delivery.
They want to look at the condition of the ice edge and the ice in and around the approaches to Nome and Nome's harbor. And another flight will probably be undertaken in advance of the actual operation.
Francis says there will be air support for the final delivery in Nome. The basic plan for the Healy to break ice to within a mile of Nome still stands, but from there to the fuel hookup is not finalized. The Renda on its own is ice-capable and could move into the lead position for the final stretch, and the Renda also carries a mile of hose. Evan says the ice conditions will be a major factor in the final connection.
One of the things that we're looking closely at is the shore ice and how the shore ice may affect where the Renda comes into and how it offloads fuel, but that we'll continue to look at until the Renda's a couple of days out.
The delivery is still 2 weeks away, but the tanker is in motion. The Renda was filled with around 1 million gallons of diesel in South Korea and departed today for Japan, where it will be filled with gasoline. A strengthening Pacific storm, however, may prevent it from making it there. The alternative is to buy gasoline in Dutch Harbor. This requires a waiver to the Jones Act, which outlaws the delivery of American goods within the U.S. on foreign flagged vessels. Evan says the team is currently looking into the logistics of securing a waiver.
It certainly adds another layer of requests and complications, but that's not unknown to us at this point in time. I mean, getting a fuel delivery through the ice to Nome has never been done before. So, with that, there's a number of complications, and this is just another one that we'll work to navigate through.
If the tanker makes it to Japan, the plan is for the Healy to meet up with the Renda somewhere north of Adak. If they have to buy gas in Dutch Harbor, the two vessels would rendezvous there and begin the trip north. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
A major reform announced last month by the Federal Communications Commission promises to extend high-speed internet access to people in rural areas across the country. But the 27% of Alaskan consumers whose internet comes through a satellite won't see the same degree of improvement. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
The Federal Communications Commission is trying to address internet inequality on a national scale by shifting $4.5 billion in government subsidies away from traditional telephone networks toward internet-based systems. The commission released the full Connect America reform order last month. It's a 759-page document, but the basic gist is that telephone companies are going to have to offer affordable broadband to their customers if they want to continue receiving federal funding. That's a big deal for Alaska, where less than 75% of residents have access to broadband. What qualifies as broadband, though, will be different for Alaskan communities served by satellite, which includes most communities off the road system. In general, the commission is calling for providers to have minimum download speeds of 4 megabits per second. That's fast enough to stream high-definition video. It's also already the standard in most urban areas. But the commission determined that requiring 4 megabits per second in communities off the fiber network was unreasonable. Here's FCC spokesperson Mark Wigfield.
For a provider, perhaps in Alaska, to reach those speed standards, they might have to launch multiple satellites. You know, a very, very expensive proposition. So we tried to be flexible. We want to make sure that everyone has broadband, but we also have to make sure that we don't break the bank or impose unrealistic requirements on providers in the process.
So they set the speed requirement considerably lower, only 1 megabit. That's still fast enough to stream low-resolution video. Dave Goggins is vice president of operations at Tel Alaska, which provides both telephone and internet services in Alaska. Goggins says 1 megabit is triple the speed his company currently offers residential customers.
It's a constant balancing act that we play, trying to provide for the needs of the community with what we've got. So the demands continue to be more and more, but our base customers' numbers remain the same.
Goggins says Tel Alaska would need to purchase at least $40,000 per month in additional bandwidth to get community-wide internet speeds up to 1 megabit. Tel Alaska CEO Brenda Shepherd says that's going to be hard without additional support.
It just won't be affordable for people.
But others are more optimistic. Heather Hudson is director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. She sees potential in the reforms for more efficient use of subsidies and, as a result, faster, cheaper telecommunications.
It's going to take some probably innovative thinking about both the technology and the business models, but I really do think that they can work and that there's enough flexibility in how the decision is written and the details that have not yet been decided that it can be fine-tuned for the Alaska context.
Representative Don Young says he's formed a House caucus to review the reforms to make sure they don't curtail investment in Alaskan telecommunications.
This is a work in progress. This is not a final set in concrete rule. And so with our input through the caucus and through members of Congress from rural areas, by listening to their constituents saying, what do we really need, I think we can change this for rural areas where the market doesn't bear the cost right away.
The FCC is taking public comment on the reforms through January 18th. In Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
A series of high wind events in Anchorage over the past several days have meant power outages due to storm damage. Chugach Electric spokesman Phil Steyer says it's too early to estimate the cost of repairs.
The series of storms that has swept through South Central in December has certainly hit the Chugach system hard, as it has other electric systems throughout the area. Chugach has not yet tallied up the cost of responding to all of the outages. It's fair to say that it's added hundreds of thousands of dollars in costs, but just how many, we don't know. And so that work is going to progress to try and account fully for the cost of responding to the storms. But we won't have that number for a while.
Steyer would not comment on whether or not the electric utility would be receiving state or federal disaster funds. He said the company is still tallying up how extensive the damage is.
Chugach serves about 80,000 metered locations. My best guess is somewhere between 10 and 20,000 of them have been affected at one time or another by this series of storms.
According to the Associated Press, Matanuska Electric Association is approaching $500,000 in costs from repairing damage from the storms, while the city's municipal light and power has suffered light damage due to mostly underground lines.
President Obama has issued a disaster declaration for storm damage in western Alaska. The declaration makes federal funds available for communities after storms battered the western coast in early November. More than 35 communities were affected. The Federal Emergency Management Agency says the funding is available to the state and eligible local and tribal governments, along with some nonprofit organizations, to repair or replace damaged buildings from the storms and flooding. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, delivering food and toys to families in need.
This is about being able to share, being able to reach out and tell people in our community at a real tough time of year that they're valued and that they're cared for.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Mushing legend Jeff King is back in the game. In his first race since retiring following the 2010 Iditarod, the Denali Park musher posted a convincing come-from-behind victory in a big early-season race this past weekend. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
After Jeff King's third place in the 2010 Iditarod, it appeared his illustrious racing career might be over. The four-time champion told KNOM Radio at the Nome finish line it was his final run in the last great race.
It's been a great trip, all 21 of them. This is an absolutely grand finale for sure.
King's 2010 Iditarod was the fourth straight won by rival Lance Mackey. King sold off most of his dogs and spent much of last winter outside, including stints as a commentator for races in Minnesota and Norway, but never strayed too far from the sport. Despite not racing last winter, King kept 20 dogs and unexpectedly signed up for the 2012 Iditarod. This past weekend, he showed he's serious. King raced to a win in the Sheep Mountain 150, besting 46 other teams, including second-place finisher Ali Zirkel.
I'm going to ride my Brett Favre wave as long as I can. If the media wants to call it out of retirement, they can call it with what they want. But the fact that I kept those 20 dogs and had them in training ready to beat the likes of Ali Zirkel's kennel and all the other top teams that were down there, I got a nice team, and I look forward to racing those people for years to come.
Fresh snow, gusty winds, and hills made for a challenging course in the three-stage Sheep Mountain event. Zirkel had 20 minutes on King, starting the last 50-mile leg. Zirkel reports on her website that the trail was hard to find moving over the last big climb and that King's team overtook hers in an area of soft trail. King went on to beat Zirkel by 20 seconds at the finish. King says his team was faster over the final miles and specifically credits his lead dogs.
I think one of the advantages for me and one of the reasons I was able to stay ahead of Allie once I got ahead of her were my leaders, Spider and Coltrane, pretty quickly found out that the trail was not where the new snowmobile track was, and they were willing to be on the firm trail that had no visual markings.
King says Sheep Mountain was the first time he's raced this group of dogs and is proud of them. King's also feeling good about himself. The 55-year-old says he's taken up a new physical training program and is in the best shape of his life. King plans on testing himself and his dogs in upcoming races, including a possible run in next month's Kuskokwim 300, a race he's won 7 times.
I see Lance Mackey signed up for it, and I want to give him a shot at me out there, just like he's given me a shot at him in the Iditarod, along with all the other great mushers that always show up. I may be going there. I am hoping to put on the Denali Doubles. It's a race I put on a couple years ago. It's got a different format. 2 mushers per team will drive across to Paxson and back. But the main focus is going to be the Iditarod. I'm going to go as fast as the dogs want to go. That's exactly what I said this weekend. When I saw that my dogs were ready to race, I raced. I ended up winning.
King says seeing John Baker win the 2011 Iditarod was exciting and showed that all racers, even fellow 4-time champ Lance Mackey, have off years. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
This week, the Food Bank and Salvation Army, along with Marine Corps Toys for Tots, held Neighborhood Gift. The annual event drew nearly 5,000 families in need to six locations for holiday dinner fixings and toys. KSKA's Len Anderson visited two of the sites.
You got a constant flow of traffic or just intermittent?
It's starting to pick up, be a little constant, but it's, you know, it's nothing overloading the lot at this time.
Thank you.
At about 2 p.m. on Neighborhood Gift Day, Brian Reel is directing traffic at one of the Clark Middle School parking lots. Volunteers go one way, those seeking toys and food to the closer lot.
We still are early. Yeah, I imagine about 5 o'clock when everybody starts getting off work, it'll really pick up. We've heard numbers like in 4 hours they'll run 15 to 2,000 people through here.
This year's numbers were not quite as high as in 2010 when over 5,200 families came to the six sites. But Clark Middle School's nearly 1,600 families again proved the highest.
941.
This is about being able to share, being able to reach out and tell people in our community at a real tough time of year that they're valued and that they're cared for.
The neighborhood gift goal expressed by Jim McKenzie with the Food Bank of Alaska was easily confirmed.
Bobby McKinley, now that I'm laid off, this gives me something that I wouldn't have been able to afford. And I think this is awesome what the organization here is doing for the community, helping people when people really need help. Just to be able to feed someone, makes them happy, and give your kid a toy.
Is this your first year here?
I've been here since 2003, but it's the first year I ever needed a hand up.
The annual event prospers on the involvement of some 2,000 volunteers, most from the faith community. That includes members of the Jewish congregation Beth Shalom, one of the distribution sites. Jenny Ragland of the Salvation Army says this giving of time, along with toys, food, and even some children's coats, bestows a special holiday quality.
We get to see volunteerism at its best. We get to see the need in our community being met because of the generosity. We say need knows no season, but really, truly, it's wonderful to be here and to help families just prepare for a wonderful holiday season.
This year saw a new West Side location. Its site director, John Fleming, said Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church replaced the Spinard Recreation Center.
We were approached and asked if we would mind taking it on this year to see how it works out, so we said, sure, why not?
It was here that Laura, one of the shopping guides, found herself in a new neighborhood gift role.
It's the first time I've been on this side of it. So when my kids were little, we came to stuff like this too. And so they're grown now, and it's just nice. It's nice to see it continuing.
As Laura helped her shopper, Glenda was showing Tammy one of the boys' tables.
He loves history and math.
Does he like games? Connects is always fun.
Oh, that's cool. I'll grab that one. Connects? Oh, that's cool.
It was Tammy's first time at Gift, but not Glenda's, nor, one suspects, her last.
I volunteered last year over at Spinard Rec Center. It was profoundly moving. I carried it with how I felt and what I wanted to do through this whole year, and wouldn't miss this for anything again this year.
Tammy was one of more than 530 families who came to Our Lady of Guadalupe during Anchorage's Neighborhood Gift. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The festivities of the holidays can serve as a bitter reminder to foster youth that they are separated from their own families. But Anchorage Representative Les Guerra says with a laptop of their own, foster children can keep connections alive with friends, even if they move from home to home.
You know, a lot of these kids, 1,500 plus foster youth in Alaska, move from house to house to house. So, you know, if they're going to have a chance in school with a computer, it's got to be a laptop that's more portable. And the other thing it does is it allows kids to have a more normalized life. You know, you can hook up with friends on Facebook. You can keep family pictures. As you move from house to house to house, you can bring the pictures with you. So it's an important thing both socially and academically.
Gara is launching the holiday effort in cooperation with the nonprofit group Facing Foster Care in Alaska. The computer drive is in its second season after a successful first run. Over the past year, the drive resulted in more than 60 matches for youth who use laptops for school and social connections. 16-year-old Anna Redmond got a laptop some months ago.
I have an HP Pavilion. It was used, but it works perfectly normal, like a brand new laptop, pretty much. It helps me because I can, if I miss school, I can look up on the ASD webpage. I can look at my teacher's assignments, and then I can get those and do them and turn them in the next day or whenever I go back to school. I'm not very good at math, so I use it to look on khanacademy.org. It's this guy, he just does web videos about stuff, and it helps me because it helps. He pretty much teaches me how to do the math in a way I'll understand it.
Those wishing to donate a laptop can contact Gara's office. Laptops suitable for the program must not be more than 4 years old and have word processing capabilities and internet capability.
If you have a 10-year-old laptop that is bogging down, we don't want it because the kid's just going to get frustrated. But if you have one that's in good working order and you're about to upgrade, or if you want to help us buy one, just let us know. The Carr Family Foundation, for example, has given us money, and Best Buy gave us a discount, and we bought 10 computers from them recently.
Gara says he was a foster child himself for a time, so he knows the importance of supporting youth in foster care.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough has awarded a contract to investigate expansion of local natural gas distribution. The $430,000 bid award to Northern Economics is for a twofold study. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says the company is charged with looking into the means and effects of getting natural gas to more Fairbanks residents.
What's the optimum business plan to reach as many areas of the borough as possible? This project will also look at the relevance of how natural gas coming into the community and reaching as many as we can in the non-attainment area for air quality, and how that can be addressed. And we're asking that firm to look at that in detail.
The state legislature provided $500,000 to the borough for the study. It's in anticipation of projects that could bring North Slope natural gas to Fairbanks. Golden Valley Electric Association and Flint Hills Refinery are looking at trucking in North Slope gas. Fairbanks Natural Gas is pursuing a similar project. FNG currently trucks Cook Inlet gas to Fairbanks, supplying more than 1,000 customers on a limited piping network in the city. Getting North Slope gas via truck or pipeline would open up the potential for larger volumes of gas and more people heating with the less polluting fuel. Borough Assembly Presiding Officer Diane Hutchinson says the study will look at the economics of getting gas to consumers outside the most developed part of the borough.
Part of the study will tell how realistic would it be to expand further out into the borough, into the less populated areas, and what would that cost be?
Hutchinson and Mayor Hopkins says once the cost of an expanded local distribution system is known, the figure can be taken to the legislature for possible state funding during the upcoming session. How do you improve Southeast Alaska's economy? Business, government, and nonprofit group leaders met in Juneau earlier this month to share and refine their ideas. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the Southeast Alaska Economic Development Cluster Summit.
The conference brought together groups concentrating on forest, ocean, and visitor products. It also included a group trying to develop a regional renewable energy industry.
The goal is to create viable economic activity in Southeast Alaska and the Tongass.
Ketchikan's John Sun co-chairs the Ocean Products Group.
And the measurement is creating new jobs, at least stopping the population drop in Southeast, and creating more private sector investment and private sector business in Southeast Alaska.
Sund is one of the more than 130 people involved in the four cluster groups since they began in 2011. A cluster is sort of like a committee or task force. It brings together individuals, companies, and agencies in the same business and geographic area. Members work on ways to collaborate, as well as develop new products or initiatives. Then they get together at events such as the summit to compare notes and see what they can work on together. The visitor industry cluster, for example, has already worked with the Forest Service to increase tour access to Juneau's Mendenhall Glacier area. It also wants to spread tourism beyond cruise line ports.
There are some communities that are never going to see any ships.
Juneau's Sharon Gateman, who works in marketing, co-chairs the visitor products group.
And so between them and our hubs, Ketchikan, Juneau, it's about developing itineraries to capture those more independent visitors.
The Forest Products Group wants to simplify the government's timber sale process, especially for small mills. It also wants to convince builders to use more regional timber products and promote waste wood energy. Co-chair Wade Zammit of Ketchikan-based Sea Alaska Timber Corporation says it's been trying to avoid duplication with another recent group.
We also began making, I think, the necessary steps for a formal process of communication with the State Timber Task Force to make sure that, you know, we're working cooperatively on initiatives and not creating redundancy, but building on what each other's doing.
The group also wants Alaska's congressional delegation to push through legislation designating lands for timber harvest in the region. The renewable energy group is just getting going since there's little industry so far. Co-chair Brandon Smith of Juneau's Alaskan Brewing Company says it's looking at tidal, wind, geothermal, biomass, and small hydro.
Big hydro projects kind of have a lot of their support structure already in place in developing those. So we chose to focus on some of the smaller ones that may need a little help in becoming part of this industry.
The Ocean Products Group is focusing on sea otter management, education and training, and salmon habitat restoration, among other issues. Wrangell's Julie Decker co-chairs that group.
The area where the United States has been strong has been innovation, and that's where we need, that's sort of our key area where we can still have a competitive advantage.
The summit was not the end of the cluster group's work. They will continue refining their ideas and choosing which ones to push the most. The event and the larger effort have been organized by the Juneau Economic Development Council. Funding has come from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which has committed another $100,000 for continued work. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.